Hello and welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
There need to be people in the world who are taking research, like the research that I do and others do, and finding a way to convey that research to teachers so that it's both digestible and compelling. And I don't think we do that very well. I think if we did that better, there might be more takers for our research-based practice initiatives.
We dedicate the entire programme this week to the second part of my interview with Professor P. David Pearson on the teaching of reading. Professor Pearson was the keynote speaker at the recent annual conference of the Reading Association of Ireland. Barry Hennessy is off this week, so we don't have any education news. In fact, beginning very soon, we'll be changing the format of the programme and the news item will be disappearing. And Barry will be bringing us up to date with more general developments in the world of education. But for now, back to this week's programme. The Reading Association of Ireland organised its 35th annual conference recently in the Church of Ireland College of Education in Rathmines. The keynote speaker there was Professor P. David Pearson from UC Berkeley. Having begun his career in education as a fifth grade teacher, Professor Pearson has made an enormous contribution to our understanding of how students learn to read. He has served as editor of numerous books and journals and has received several awards for his contribution to research on reading. On last week's programme, I brought you his views on teaching reading across the curriculum, on the teaching and assessment of reading comprehension, and on the relationship between decoding text and comprehension. This week, he addresses some more issues in the teaching of reading. I began by asking him what we know about the teaching of reading today that we didn't know when he began his career. In the course of his response, Professor Pearson refers to the DIBELS test. This stands for the Dynamic Indicators of Basic Early Literacy Skills.
Well, let's see. I started graduate school in 1966. So how many years? That's 45 years ago? Yeah. Well, first of all, almost everything we know about comprehension instruction and the nature of comprehension has been either discovered or at least, if not discovered, dramatically refined since that time. You know, when I was a graduate student at the University of Minnesota and I told my advisor I wanted to study comprehension, nobody could understand why I wanted to do that. Because, you know, the ongoing issues were the issues in early reading and decoding. And it just astounded me that so few people were looking at comprehension. So I had to go over to the psychology department where a new field called psycholinguistics was just starting to be formed and people were starting to do work in it. And between psycholinguistics and cognitive psychology and what we call the cognitive revolution that occurred in the 70s, I think our understanding about both the content and the processes of reading comprehension we had almost no infrastructure for those ideas in 1966. And now we've got a very elaborate body of work looking at both basic processes as well as instructional strategies in reading comprehension. So that would certainly be one area. A second area that we alluded to earlier is we knew next to nothing about dyslexic readers then. And I think that the depth of work on understanding dyslexic readers and what to do about them is also much richer today than it was when I started. And as I think about it, almost every area of teaching reading is much more is much richer and much more elaborated now than it was then. The whole issue of grouping and whether you teach kids in whole class, small group, one-on-one, and the like, that's much richer now than it was then. You know, we now know that if you can find the time and the money for it, that tutoring, particularly for young readers, is the way to go. I mean, when those kids get one-on-one attention that focuses precisely on their strengths and weaknesses, they can make really good progress. So I think all those things are much better now than they, much more elaborated and much richer lines of inquiry than they were 45 years ago. So in that respect, as much as I complain about our lack of progress, I guess when you look at it in the big picture, we really are, as a profession, a lot better off now than we were then. We still debate a lot. We still have these tensions and these sort of ideological wars about how to teach reading and, you know, what constitutes good research and the like. But at least the debate is at a, I guess, a higher plane than it was 20 or 30 or 40 years ago.
And if we move then a little bit closer to the present, and if you look, say, maybe over the last decade, are there any research projects or any research findings that have particularly excited you in the last 10 years that maybe they're just promising what might be ahead?
Well, yes, I actually think that the focus of my talk this morning, understanding the nature of reading and writing in the disciplines, and learning how to unpack that and then trying to ferret out what's common across reading and writing in science and social studies and literature and what's different about those, that we know a lot more about that whole area of activity than we did a decade ago. And of course, I'm biased. I like the work that I'm doing with my colleagues at Lawrence Hall of Science now, where we're trying really, really hard to use reading, writing, and academic language as tools for enhancing knowledge and inquiry in science. I would welcome somebody to do the same kind of work in social studies, because I worry that history and the study of politics and the like, both at the elementary and secondary level, is not getting the kind of attention it deserves. But I just think that that work is very exciting, because I think what it shows is that if you set out to make kids good readers or good writers of this discipline, that may be the best bet for helping them develop more generic approaches and strategies to reading and writing. And I'm interested to know, if I teach you to be a good summarizer or a good critic of science texts, does that help your capacity to summarize and critique literature texts or history texts? And I think that's that whole area of work is, as it plays out, and it's beginning to build a lot of momentum, at least in the United States. And I think in other countries too. I've seen some of the same trends in Australia on my visits there, and I just don't know enough about what's going on in the over here in the Emerald Isle or in the UK to know how much it's caught on over here.
And what questions have yet to be answered by research into reading?
Well, clearly, some questions haven't been answered. Otherwise, we wouldn't keep debating things like what's the best way to teach beginning reading. So that hasn't been answered to the criterion if beyond a reasonable doubt. You know, there's still enough ambiguity in the data to allow people to hold very different ideological views about how to teach reading. I think we still don't know. I think we know a lot about the impact of knowledge on comprehension. The more you know about something, the easier it is to understand what you read. I don't think we know as much about the reciprocal side, the impact of comprehension on knowledge. That is, we've tended to view that as a one-way street, and we haven't looked at the other side of it much. That is, when you're reading and you understand something, what does that do to the store of knowledge? Presumably, when you understand something, you now know something you didn't know before, and that knowledge sort of seeps back into your long-term memory and is there to help you understand the next bit. And the way I like to think of it is that, you know, your your the knowledge that helps you understand page 5 includes what you just learned on pages 1 through 4. And we tend not to think of knowledge that way. We tend to think of knowledge as what you bring to the class, not the knowledge that's constructed in the process of reading. And the way I like to say it is that we forget that for so many kids who depend upon school to learn to read, that today's new knowledge is tomorrow's prior knowledge that helps them understand. And so I think understanding the other side of that equation is something that we haven't done very well. The other issues that vex me are as much political and policy issues as they are research issues. In the U.S., the problem is not the average achievement of American school children. In point of fact, if you look at our national assessment of educational progress over the last 40 years, kids are reading somewhat better now than they did 40 years ago. And they certainly aren't reading, as most of our politicians would have us believe, worse. You know, we manufacture these crises all the time for purposes of making political hay. So the problem isn't the average. The problem that we have in the United States is the variability and the our seeming incapacity to help those kids most in need of our help. It's the educational have-nots and the persistence of the achievement gap that I think vexes us and makes it hard for us to sleep at night. And until and unless we find ways of either closing that gap or at least moving up the bottom of the achievement distribution to an acceptable level, I think we'll continue to have educational insomnia.
Well, manufactured or not, Irish policymakers at the moment are concerned about our levels of achievement of students in the PISA test. The results were published at the end of last year. What do you think policymakers can do to raise reading literacy among students? And whether it is those lowest achieving students or students in general, what can we do to raise a country's performance in reading literacy?
Well, I'm also, you know, not against accountability. I think it's reasonable for schools to be accountable for students' progress. I think the problem with most accountability systems, well, there are two problems with it. Number one is make sure you're measuring what matters to you. In the United States, during the No Child Left Behind days, somehow we became convinced that assessments like the DIBELS, which measure how many phonemes you can name in a minute, how many letters you can name in a minute, how many words you can read in a minute, how many ideas you can recall in a minute, somehow those speeded measures of reading became the criteria on which we were going to hold ourselves accountable. And those are what I call enabling skills. It's always dangerous to be held accountable to enabling skills. We should instead hold ourselves accountable to valued outcomes. Things, when we look at it, say, yeah, that's what I mean by reading, or yeah, that's what I mean by writing. And you know, you can almost tell it at an intuitive level. And so, first of all, making sure that we're accountable for things that matter. And then secondly, recognizing that when we put sanctions, rewards and sanctions in our accountability system, that there will always be a tendency for people to engage in hypercorrection. And what I mean by that is that they'll take those outcomes, those indicators that you're measuring, as the goals. And what happens in so often is that a perfectly good test that's good for monitoring progress is a good indicator, but it's not the goal. And when it becomes the goal, then the system gets corrupted. It would be like hospitals turning temperatures that from the thermometer into their goals. And we were going to say, you know, We want to, the goal in our hospital, to lower the average temperature of patients by 1.2 degrees. I mean, you know, we know that temperature is a symptom of something else going wrong, not the cause of it. And, you know, we get these measures in there and they take over the system. So, and the way I like to think about it is that when you have high stakes and you have low challenge assessments, high stakes are always going to be dangerous because people are going to teach to the high stakes. But the worst situation you can have is high stakes and low challenge, because that will drive the curriculum down to the lowest common denominator. And that will never get us ahead. It will never get us better workers and more college-ready students. If that's what you want, then if you're going to have high stakes, at least have the courtesy of having high challenge attached to those stakes.
Okay, and the PISA results then. So really, we shouldn't be just aiming to improve them. We should be looking at a broader picture in terms of trying to have more learners be better readers.
Well, you know, I sort of know what's on the PISA test, and it's not unlike our NAEP, National Assessment of Educational Progress, and it's a mixture of, you know, constructed response and multiple choice items, and I think it's a pretty well designed reading comprehension assessment. So I'm not going to say bad things about the PISA, but you want kids to get higher scores on PISA, because not because you had them practice PISA like test items, you know, every Friday for all year. You want them to get higher scores on PISA because your curriculum was so well balanced and so intensive and rich that kids got better at everything, including being able to score well on the PISA. And by the way, the same thing is true of DIBELS. I want kids to read faster. I think it's great if kids are more fluent and can read more words in a minute, but not because we practice time trials five times a week, because we taught everything, you know, the oral language, the vocabulary, the reading comprehension strategies, the discussion. We taught all the knowledge acquisition. All those things were taken care of in a balanced program, and as a result, they get better at everything, including being able to take standardized tests.
Dublin Radio at its best, 103.2. This is Dublin City FM.
In 2000, the National Reading Panel in the United States identified as essential components of reading phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension. Did they miss anything?
The National Reading Panel, everything that's on there is worthy of our close attention. But it's not as though those five categories came through, you know, stone tablets or anything like that. Those five categories happen to represent two things. Number one, the interests of the panel members. And number two, areas in which there was at least initial consensus that there might be enough experimental research such that they could do what researchers call a meta-analysis, that is, they could look at all the research that had been done and then draw a conclusion about which were the most effective ways of teaching those particular skills. But it's not as though those were magic. And are things left out? Yes. With respect to reading, there's no mention at all of the reciprocal relationship of reading and writing. And there's a fair amount of research suggesting that if you teach writing well, that it has a nice residual effect on improving reading comprehension. There's no mention at all in that panel discussion of the importance of talk about text. Well, there's a huge body of research on the impact of discussion on learning content and also on comprehension, and that's not mentioned at all. There's a huge body of research on the ideal ways in which to group students for instruction. Do you teach whole class, small group, put kids in pairs, tutor them? There's a big body of research on that, and none of that is dealt with. Now, why isn't it dealt with? It was simply a matter of they couldn't do everything, so they picked what they thought, you know, by their collective professional judgment, were the five most important things, and that's where the big five come from. And, you know, I think what's there deserves to be there and be mentioned. But we shouldn't forget about the fact that when teachers and principals and school boards are out to build local reading programs, they can't just stop with the big five. They've got to go on and take on other issues like grouping, assessment, discussion, reading and writing relationships, all those things. When push comes to shove, when you're teaching reading, you got to do it all. You can't hope that just by teaching kids to decode that comprehension will magically happen. You can't pretend that just because you focus on meaning that kids will learn to unlock the code and be able to pronounce words. And, you know, I think good teachers in every country in the world have known for a long time that you can't let one of these curriculum foci dominate over the others. Hence the term balanced literacy curriculum, which sometimes gets a bad rap because people think it's, oh, just a little bit of everything. But it really represents an attempt, I think, on the part of teachers to make sure that kids develop a full toolbox, a full repertoire of reading skills and strategies so that they're able to, you know, meet the demands of schools and able to, you know, sort of start meeting the demands of disciplinary curricula too.
And when you talk about a balanced reading curriculum, for people who mightn't be familiar with that, what are the elements of that?
Oh, well, I think, you know, it's certainly includes the big five from the National Reading Panel. There's nothing on there that I wouldn't include in my curriculum. But I would probably add a strong emphasis on oral language development, which isn't in the big five. I would probably also add an emphasis on ensuring that every child has an independent, personalized reading program, that in addition to reading what everybody else is reading and what's required in the class, that kids are also reading for personal pleasure and the development of insight and the development of interests on a daily basis.
What would be on a curriculum for teachers maybe who have 10 or 15 years of experience teaching so that they could improve their teaching of reading?
Well, I just think that the best way for teachers to improve their teaching of reading is to align themselves with some kind of consistent professional activity. You know, there was a time 30 years ago when there was very little professional development provided by our public schools and by our federal programs, when teachers were thirsting for knowledge and joined voluntary professional associations like the RAI here in Ireland. But in the States, we've had so much school-based professional development that the opportunity for teachers to get engaged in these activities within their professional associations has just withered. I think they're just tired of so much activity. But I think without that sort of ongoing mechanism, I don't know that we can specify the exact content that you need to acquire. But teachers always need to be learning something new. And by the way, the other side of that coin is that there need to be people in the world who are taking research, like the research that I do and others do, and finding a way to convey that research to teachers so that it's both digestible and compelling. And I don't think we do that very well. I think if we did that better, there might be more takers for our research-based practice initiatives. So I think part of the problem is on the production side. Part of it's on the teacher reception side. Are you willing to listen to this stuff? And then part of it part of the problem is in the communication issues, and that is finding ways to sort of package knowledge and research findings so that, what were the words I used? Compelling and digestible. It has to be both.
And finally, David, your own experience of learning to read. Can you remember anything about it and what made it so good? Because presumably it was.
I will never forget going to school I went to a one-room schoolhouse in the Central Valley of California. We lived a mile from the school, and my sister was in eighth grade, my brother was in sixth grade, and I was in first grade. And they
all in the one room?
All in the one-room schoolhouse, yep. And we had a horse, and my brother and sister rode on the horse, and I walked behind them. And then as we walked down the county road, we picked up other kids along the way and who lived on that road, and it was exactly a mile to the school, Pleasant Prairie Elementary School, and our teacher was Mrs. Millsap, one-room schoolhouse. And I remember coming home the first day of school, and I was crying, and my mom said, "What's wrong?" She said, "Well, I went to school today, and Danny Corcoran, who lives down the road, can read, and I can't, and I want to know why." She said, "David, don't you worry. All your brothers and sisters, I'm the youngest of six, learned how to read, and so will you. Trust me." And so, you know, I did, and I went back to school, and, you know, Danny Corcoran was still, he could read all the stories and stuff like that, and I was just struggling with the words. And I noticed along about October, you know, we started in September, I was starting to catch up with him a little bit. And along about November, I was pulling neck and neck with him. And by Christmas time, I was actually ahead of Danny Corcoran. And it didn't occur to me until years later when I became a reading professor what had happened. And what I didn't realize is that this was Danny Corcoran's second year in first grade. He had to repeat first grade. So he had memorized all those early stories and could, you know, just spout them off verbatim without reading anything. But then, you know, when the stories got harder about Christmas time, then he was in trouble again. So, you know, so I ended up, my mom's prediction was right. I did become a competent reader and the like, and a teacher of reading. But and by the way, I don't want anyone to worry about Danny Corcoran, because he went on to be a very, very successful farmer in the Central Valley of California and makes 10 times more money than I will ever dream about making. So I don't want you to think that he lived a life of misery because of that. But at any rate, yeah, so I have a very particular memory of learning how to read.
And that was Professor P. David Pearson from UC Berkeley. He was in Ireland as a guest of the Reading Association of Ireland. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on InsideEd.com or on iTunes. You can email us at InsideEducation@DublinCityFM.ie. Thanks to my guest, Professor P. David Pearson. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.